You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
Yes. We wish to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations lands, which lands were previously occupied by the Seneca and Huron-Wendat First Nations.
I just want to remind you about the table that we have in the hall. It was in the middle of the aisle for some weeks. It's now at the back. And those of you who aren't familiar with it, we had laid one row symbolically of the two-row wampum, which called us to journey with our Indigenous sisters and brothers. Originally, it's the original symbolic of the original treaty. We laid the calls to action from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission upon that side, their side, of that two-row wampum, and recognized that we had not yet started walking properly with them. So anyone who has not participated is invited to take a ribbon from the far side, like there's one with a solid purple ribbon underneath it and then small ribbons on top of it. Take one of them, read it, and place it on our side. And that's symbolically noting that we will take responsibility now for the relationship with our Indigenous neighbors, sisters and brothers in this community and across the country, and we will call our communities and our nation to account for that. So please participate in that as you feel comfortable during the service or following the service so that we can make that whole side of our responsibility complete with the recommendations that had come out of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission on Residential Schools. Thank you.
Grounded, Guided, Growing, A Time for Centering, from Scott Kearns.
We've just come back from being away at a conference center. During one of the weeks, Greta was asked to be the chaplain for the United Church of Christ group there. This is a denomination that has aligned itself with the United Church of Canada, and just an in-house comment, it was lovely for me to see, while the United Church has still designated Greta as unsuitable, the United Church of Christ has asked her to be chaplain for a week and lead all the services. And I'm not doing that in a disrespectful way. I'm just saying it was a very affirming and lovely thing to be part of that. She led the services beautifully, as you would expect. And I just wanted to say one of the things she did. Their theme is, "May we, till we are all one." And Greta had everybody in the congregation, chapel, about 35 people, fill out a piece of paper, and at the top of it, a little square, and it said, "You are welcome here." And she asked everybody to, "Excuse me for just a minute. Are you going to do this in your message?"
"No, I might do it."
"Okay. But I want to tell them what you did." I just thought it would be really bad, wouldn't it? I did it, and that was her message this morning. No, if we don't talk in the morning, you are welcome here. And one of the things she asked people to do was to say, "What quality or what part of you have you been excluded in your life? What have you felt shut out, not part of, not welcomed because of?" And she gave a few examples of her own to start people off thinking. And there were so many words on those pages of why people felt left out, or why an organization they belonged to left a certain kind of person out. And we've all felt that left out part, at least I think we all have. I have. Sometimes for ways I am, and sometimes for things I can do nothing about. And those are probably the harder ones. But I was thinking of what we talked about and Greta mentioned, the grounded. When we say we're grounded in the interconnectedness of life, we really mean we're all one family. Animal life, everything, we are one family, connected. And how we treat each other is so critically important. And that those values come to life in the way we are with each other. Sometimes, I mean, you can think of someone right now that it's just so easy to love, just so easy to like. It doesn't even take any effort. But you can also think of someone or types of people it's a little more challenging for you to do. And so you weren't thinking of each other there. You were. But when we say grounded, we mean really that we take our stand among that family and hold ourselves accountable for how we treat one another. And we choose the value of love to be guided by, and we choose to share wisdom because we can't do it alone. So I just wanted to share a bit of that with you. It was beautifully received. She took all the papers, everyone took their paper of what you are welcome to, you know, no matter of these qualities, and put them all over the door of the entrance to the building. And it was just a beautiful, beautiful, and the people took pictures of it. So that's what she was doing while she was away, and it was well received, and the message was the same.
The first reading this morning is from David Copperfield, and this is the same David Copperfield that many of you have seen on TV, the illusionist. I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times about the amazing effect of shared wonder. How I have an audience filled with people who you'd think would hate each other, people from every religious category, all at the same show at the same time. And it's an amazing phenomenon to watch the shared sense of wonder, where these people who really don't like each other for good and bad reasons, that make sense and don't make sense, are in the common room experiencing this unification, offered as wisdom for the journey. The next reading is from Robert Jackson, and he participated as a legal counsel at the Nuremberg trials. Those who begin elimination of dissent soon find themselves eliminating dissenters. Compulsory unification of opinion achieves only the unanimity of the graveyard. Offered as wisdom for the journey, may we walk in its light.
Focused Moments from Greta Vosper.
I wrote the focus moment early in the week. Often when I'm creating the service, I do my readings and I choose the quotes and I create the focus moment all on the same day. And then often I set it aside because I'm doing other things and some of it's percolating, and when I'm reading something, I'll think, oh, that would go with the theme. And sometimes it's completely obliterated by the rest of the week. I pick it up, you know, towards the end of the week and I go, I don't even remember what this was about. And that's sort of what happened this week, simply because of the engagement at Chautauqua and how heavily intellectual and aesthetic that was while we were there. So when I looked at it again and went in a somewhat different direction, the reading still held and the focus moment still holds. And so sometimes things that we create are so basic and elemental that it doesn't matter what we're coming at with them, they still speak truth to the realities that we find ourselves in. No one said this would be easy, this making things right, this working things out. But some days I don't even know where to start. Or if I even should. We are so much alike. We eat, breathe, make love. We raise our children, bring them up the best we can, sometimes with nothing, and hope their lives are overpoured with happiness. We cry and die and leave our memories behind, sometimes to flit across another's mind, dust motes on a sunny day. And though like leaves on a tree, our faces, our gait, our bodies are each different, it is what we never see that divides us more cleanly. What we've lived, what we've loved, what we've survived. Scott has already shared with you that we were at Chautauqua this last couple of weeks. It's the first time I've been able to be there for 2 weeks. I think maybe Scott has been there for 2 weeks before, but that was before me. Chautauqua is where we got married, sight unseen. I kept telling people throughout the weeks that it's an extraordinary woman that allows their husband-to-be to pick the venue without ever even seeing it. But I fell in love with Chautauqua immediately. It's a beautiful, beautiful place, considered America's best small town, though it's a gated community with a huge gate price to get in, so I'm not quite sure how it can justify itself as America's best smallest town. But it's been there for well over 100 years, beginning as a Sunday school community, where people who taught Sunday schools, often Sunday schools were the only schools at the time, since children at that time labored alongside adults. And so Sunday was the only their only opportunity to gain knowledge. And so people would come generally by paddle wheel to this campsite, and they'd learn about science, about literature, about history, and of course about religion. And over time, Victorian homes were built that housed people when they came, and it is now a protected architectural haven for Victorian architecture, and is a lovely place to go. I'll read you its mission statement. Chautauqua is dedicated to the exploration of the best in human values and the enrichment of life through a program that explores the important religious, social, and political issues of our times, stimulates provocative, thoughtful involvement of individuals and families in creative response to such issues, and promotes excellence and creativity in the appreciation, performance, and teaching of the arts. While we were there, you pay your gate fee, and you get to go to anything that's on in the amphitheater. An open-air amphitheater that seats about 5,000 people. There are lectures every morning at 10:45, and in the evening at 8:15, there are spectacular demonstrations of the arts. It's a school for dance, for music, and for vocal singing, for drama, for opera, all kinds of things. So while we were there, we several times watched the Chautauqua Symphony Orchestra, which is made up of people who play in orchestras across the country, who gather there in their off months and put together this incredible orchestra that presented a variety of things. We listened to the student orchestra, 84 young people who are there, many of them on scholarships, learning more about their craft, even there was a student conductor who twice led the symphony. We saw ballet, the students there, and Charlotte, the Charlotte Ballet Company, which brought the most incredible dance to the stage that I have ever seen. I would never consider myself a ballet aficionado, But these were not what anyone's preconceived notion of ballet would have been. They were moving and euphoric and dramatic and powerful and wonderful. We skipped Sheryl Crow, watched it from the porch. She drew a huge crowd, and we listened to Garrison Keillor on Friday night tell some jokes and sing some songs and be Garrison Keillor to the crowd. So it's an incredibly rich opportunity. The first week we were there, when I was the chaplain at the United Church of Christ, the theme for the week, there are 9 weeks, each one of them with a theme. The theme for that week was crisis of faith, ? And it seemed to lean more toward the ? Than toward admitting that there was a crisis of faith. But during the conversations that took place throughout the week in gathered groups and in the gathering of the chaplains with the religion department heads and those kinds of things, it was clear that there was a group of people who felt they were not being heard or represented in anything that was happening in the institution. And they raised their voices on several times in questioning the speakers or engaging the leaders of the institution, and bringing the idea that the fastest growing religious demographic in the United States, the nuns, or those who consider themselves secular or spiritual but not religious, as Kara would have identified herself, don't see themselves reflected in the traditional Christian and now increasingly Jewish and Islamic themes that come to the fore. And so that group, I think, will begin to get some more engagement over the next few years as they want to be seen and known and recognized in participation. The second week focused on geopolitics, and speakers from the Center for Strategic and International Studies spoke on each of the mornings, bringing considerations from cybersecurity to energy concerns and the Middle East and all kinds of issues to the fore. There CSIS had me wondering why Canadian Security and Intelligence Service was speaking at Chautauqua for 5 days straight, until I found out that it was actually the Center for Strategic and International Studies. So we engaged on all those topics in many different ways. But as I reflect on that week, and as I pondered some of the news items that came to the fore as I was there, some more serious and more urgent issues came to the fore for me. And so this morning, although the last time I was here, I think I invited all of you who are schooled in difficult conversations to take upon the difficult conversation around Indigenous peoples and our two-row commitment to them, and have that conversation with your friends and family, and that was important. Today I'm going to reignite a conversation that we had here some time ago and that I think we need to have again. And I need to tell you that I'm doing it without having discussed it with the board, without having run it by with my MMP chair or my husband. I'm just bringing it here because I don't think that we have the opportunity to wait any longer about these conversations. And so basically I'm living into the responsibility that Chautauqua places before people to engage the significant issues, religious, social, and political, and to come up with provocative and responses that family and participants can engage with, and that's what I'm offering to you today in that spirit. Some years ago, I read a book by Thich Nhat Hanh, a Buddhist monk, Tibetan monk, who brings much to the concept of mindfulness and being aware. And in the book, it was talking about the way we eat, what we eat, and shared that for most of us, if we're looking for mindfulness, if we're looking for wholeness in our own selves, how can we possibly expect to get it when most of the food that we put in our bodies is prepared for us in an extraordinarily violent way? And he drew these connections between animal agriculture, between the grinding of wheat even, to the milling of coffee beans, and all of the things that have some kind of violent way that it gets into our food substances and onto our plates. mashed potatoes. I mean, how many times did you watch your mother take out her day's events with the mashed potatoes, right? He was talking about violence with which all of our food is prepared. And I thought, I can't do that. That's ridiculous. I can't ascribe myself to seeing the world of food as entirely violent. But I recognized sometime later that that wasn't a can't. That was a won't. Because clearly there are people in the world who eat like that, who don't, engage in some kind of violent mashing of potatoes in order to enjoy them. We recognize that life is based upon the destruction of things around us that we consume. Consumption is inherently a violent act in one way or another. And so our foods will always be ground into something as we put them into our mouths. But perhaps the mashing of potatoes could happen a little differently. It was my can't when it could have been my won't. And taking ownership for my won't is one of the things that I try to do regularly. After the movie Avatar, all of you saw the movie Avatar, I'm thinking. After that movie, there was an article in Religion Dispatches by Ryan, and I shared that article with you and talked about it because one of the images that he brought into that article, which I thought was so significant and so moving, was the idea that we don't actually do anything, we don't actually pay attention to anything significant until it breaks our hearts. His actual quote is, "The truth, however inconvenient it may be, simply does not matter unless it breaks one's heart." And his whole article was entitled, "No Garden to Get Back to." He was talking about what he called an ecological depressive state that one returned to the real world, found in the real world, that contrasted so deeply with what was seen in Avatar, that dream of how we could live if we had some other dimension to which we could, you know, fall asleep and wake up in. And some of us maybe do in the course of our dreams. I also was thought as I was preparing today about Rob Stewart, the filmmaker who died earlier this year, tragically drowning after one of his dives, took upon himself the work of helping the world understand about sharks and how their harvesting for shark fin soup and for aphrodisiacs was killing an entire population in the ocean. He swam with sharks. He held them and petted them and showed that they were not inherently violent as we so often are. But at one of his lectures about the work that he did on sharks, a young woman stood up and asked him why he was devoting so much interest and energy on just sharks, when the United Nations had noted that by 2048, all of the fish in the sea might be gone, that we wouldn't be able to get any food from the sea at all by 2048, and that was fast arising. And he just kind of stared at her as he let that information seep into him. And following that, he came out with his film Revolution, which is about the climate experience happening in the world and how we might be able to address it. And so with Ryan Croken and Rob Stewart's work emboldening me, I step back to some of the work that has been done here in the past. I'm going to read you something. It's the abstract of a scientific paper and the significance of that scientific paper. And I'm going to try to explain it as I go along because it goes to something that is breaking my heart now and that I think we need to embrace long and hard enough that it breaks all of our hearts. And then find a way to move forward. It's that perhaps that provocative part of the Chautauqua influence. My sister, however, posted on Facebook, my younger sister, I'm the second child in a family of four, posted on Facebook an article and said, "What do you think about this, Greta?" And tagged me on it. The article said, "New evidence shows that second-born children are more likely to be troublemakers." So I'm just owning that before we go ahead. and perhaps you'll forgive me this conversation. The article is by a number of scientists who are acknowledging that biological annihilation due to the ongoing sixth mass extinction is enormously difficult, and that it is signaled by vertebrate population losses and declines. We generally track the losses of animals by their extinctions, but this group of scientists decided that it wasn't just the extinctions, it was the loss of habitat that we needed to pay attention to as well, and that the loss of habitat, which led to the loss of numbers, so animals that once roamed, lions that once roamed almost the entire continent of Africa, are now confined to less than 20% of that area, perhaps even less than that at this point. And to take that as an indicator of what the future of the Earth might look like and how we may require to impact ourselves and our own lifestyles as a result of that. The significance is the first piece. The strong focus on species extinctions, a critical aspect of the contemporary pulse of biological extinction, leads to a common misimpression that Earth's biota, biological family, is immediately threatened, just slowly entering an episode of major biodiversity loss. So in other words, most of the studies show that we're losing biodiversity, and we know that, but that it's gradual and not something to frighten us. This view overlooks the current trends of population declines and extinctions. Using a sample of 27,600 terrestrial vertebrate species and a more detailed analysis of 177 mammal species, we show the extremely high degree of population decay in vertebrates, even in common species of low concern. Dwindling population sizes and range shrinkages amount to a massive anthropogenic erosion of biodiversity. That means an erosion of biodiversity caused by human beings and of ecosystem services essential to civilization. This biological annihilation underlines the seriousness for humanity of Earth's ongoing sixth mass extinction event. Now, the abstract is more complicated, and perhaps I won't read it. But basically, it says that almost half of the known vertebrate species on the Earth, that's half of the known animals that we know about, and many of us probably have no idea about even three-quarters of them, but half of the known vertebrate species on Earth have experienced 32% decline. They've decreased in population size and in the amount of area that they have that they can live on. Of the 177 mammals that they actually captured data for, all have lost at least 30% of their geographic ranges, and more than 40% of the species have lost more than 80% of the land that they normally ranged upon. Our data indicate that beyond global species extinctions, Earth is experiencing a huge episode of population declines and extirpations, which will have a negative cascading consequence on ecosystem functioning and services vital to sustaining civilization. We're all falling asleep. This is scientific stuff. Blah, 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 blah. So the question is, what is the result? And the scientists at the end have this to say. The resulting biological annihilation obviously will have serious ecological, economic, and social consequences. Humanity will eventually pay a very high price for the decimation, which used to be 10% but now generally means enormous, decimation of the only assemblage of life that we know of in the universe. And I loved that phrase, the only assemblage of life that we know of in the universe is here on this planet. And we are fortunate to be amongst it, to have our experiences, to engage in the arts, to talk about what's going on in our lives, to find those who care for us and whose hearts will break if something bad happens to us, and who will reach out and help us, and we will do the same. We have an experience of life that is rich and full and profound, and we enjoy it incredibly. But we are also part of that species alive at the time when this incredible extinction is taking place, where the loss of biodiversity on the world is going to have enormous consequences, like the end of life in the oceans by 2048. These are the realities with which we currently live. But the realities of that in 2048 and beyond will be incredibly greater. I think I've mentioned before that I was at a speech that Bill McKibben gave, founder of 350.org, which tries to keep the amount of parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere down to 350, and it's actually now up over 400. And he said that those who are currently in school, at college or at university, who may have expected, as we did, to be at the peak of our careers in 30 or 35 years, in 30 or 35 years will be spending all of their creative resources dealing with emergency response. That they won't be doing the nursing or the teaching or the business stuff that they had dreamt of doing. They'll be dealing with emergency response. Context is everything. And our won'ts are often connected to our contexts. They are often we can't. Not because we wouldn't if we could, but because our situation and our realities are such that we can't. So while in here we talk each week and we hear over the course of a year, I don't know how many situations of social or climate or indigenous or sexual or gender justice issues are named in this space, we couldn't possibly attend to all of them. Our contexts don't allow us to do so. Some of us support things with financial support. Some of us offer our own time and resources to volunteer organizations. Some of us build relationships with individuals in need. We deal with what we can deal with from where we are in our lives. But we're at a point right now where there's another issue that I think we need to talk about. And as a church, work toward engaging in a different way. It's an issue that has been out there for a very long time. It's an issue that we've explored some time ago and then backed off on. But it's an issue that is crucial to that mass extinction. The mass extinction that we're experiencing, a lot of it has to do with population growth. The planet has too many people on it. And as one of the scientists in one of the articles I read said, we're going to have to get to a point where population is going to have to be reduced dramatically. And none of us are going to want to do that. I mean, how would we figure that out? How would we decide, okay, we're going to annihilate these people? We're not going to have to do that. There are whole populations that are going to starve to death. There are other whole populations that are going to die of diseases that we can no longer treat or that we never could treat. There are populations that are going to adjust themselves in some way or another. But the piece that we can personally take on is consumption, because the wealthiest people in the world consume resources at a rate that is speeding that biodiversity decline and the extinction of so many species on this planet, the very species that bring us our food and our sustenance. And we are part of one of those richest nations that consumes an incredible amount. So how can we track and address this? And I'm inviting you to do a personal inventory. There's lots of online ways that you can figure out what your footprint on the earth is. You fill in, you know, what kind of car you drive and how far you drive and how much food you eat and how much waste you have and how much shopping you do in a month. And you can figure out how many Earths it would take to maintain it if our entire earthly population consumed at the rate that we consume. I did it several years ago, and it was something like 8. I was stunned. I mean, I'm a vegetarian. I don't consume a whole lot of anything. But it would for the entire population of the Earth, 7.4 billion now, if they were to live the way I live, we'd need 8 Earths to provide the kind of resources that would be needed to live according to my lifestyle. Between, I think it's 1980 and 1989, the United States grew in its size by a huge proportion, but a factor of 17, it increased the amount of consumption that each individual had. So it wasn't just population growth, it was incredible consumption as well. And so while some authors might have said, you know, in the 1970s, there's going to be this big correcting thing because we're never going to be able to afford the population that we have, new technologies and food development took care of that, and we continued to grow. Back in 2007, that's 10 years ago, a video went online, which has now been seen by over 3 billion people. It's an incredible little video about it's got one of those little graph things that you can look at. And the person who made it was talking about climate change. And his question was, okay, so what do we do about climate change? It's two arguments. One says that it's humans contribute to climate change, and one says humans don't. And one group says we should do something about it, and others say we shouldn't. So he made this little chart, and he said, no, humans don't have anything to do with it, or yes, they do have something to do with it, or yes, we should do something about it, or no, we shouldn't do something about it. And then he went through those four quarters and said, so what would happen? You know, what would happen? If we don't have anything to do with it, but we did something about it anyways, what would it cost us? Well, we would have spent some money on developing new energy technologies. We would have perhaps developed new food things. We would have spent some money, and it would have been for no particular reason because climate change wasn't real. This is 10 years ago, remember? Our statistics and our information is much. We have a lot more of that 10 years later. And if it was and we spent money, then we could improve things, right? We could make things better. And then if climate change isn't humanly created and we don't do anything about it, it's no big deal, right? But if it is humanly created and we don't do anything about it, it has catastrophic consequences, of which these articles were telling us. And of course, they always put in the article that there are some people who don't agree with that. But when you look at this little chart, the question is, okay, where do you want to place your bets? Likely, you want to place your bets on let's do something about it, because even if there's nothing, you know, it isn't real, we're not going to hurt anything. We're just going to maybe have some great new technologies, right, that we could use anyway. But if we don't, the repercussions are catastrophic. That was in 2007. In 2009, the board responded to a request to have two people join them and talk to us about a book that had been studied the year before in the book study by Peter Singer called The Ethics of What We Eat. And that book talked about the food, animal agricultural business, how animals are treated, and what the effect of animal agriculture in our diets has on the earth. We had them join us. They made a presentation, and they challenged us to read again some of the documents that we had subscribed to. One of them was the Charter of Compassion, one of them was the Earth Charter, and the other one was one we'd written ourselves called VisionWorks. And aligning itself with all three of those documents was a call that they were making to us to find a way for the congregation to support a vegan or vegetarian food preference choice. By February of that year, of the next year, like a few months later, all hell had broken loose in this congregation. Everyone was sure that we had copied the keys to their homes and were going to go in and pull every meat or animal-based product out of their kitchen refrigerators, their basement freezers, and their bathroom cosmetics drawers. That we were going to go in and take that away from everyone and then tell everyone how bad they were, piling it all up here in front so we'd embarrass you about this, about that. And we had to back off. We were having a spaghetti dinner that year. It was being organized, and the people who were putting it together had decided to have a vegetarian spaghetti dinner so that there would be cheese options. You could put cheese on your spaghetti, but there would be no meat in the spaghetti sauce. The effect, the reaction from the congregation was so huge that we had spaghetti and meatballs. And over the course of the next year, I think we ate more meat in this building than we had in the 10 years previous, because we responded so badly. And I take some responsibility for this, to a request that came from someone in the community. I have no idea how to get to half of your homes, let alone have a key to let me in and raid your refrigerator and your freezer and find out what it is you eat. But I do have a key to this place. And we have, at that time, we tried to accommodate to a certain degree. And so we always have vegan and vegetarian options available. And we now also try to include gluten-free, and we have a nut-free facility, which doesn't mean that nuts don't get in here. It means that people need... I wasn't talking about you, Roger. It doesn't mean... I'm talking about actual nuts that people have an allergic reaction to. But people know that if they have concerns, they can ask, and we can tell them whether an item has nuts in it or not. So we try to provide a safe environment. And so those are the food things that we've done. But I would like to challenge us to go a step further and make this a vegan building. And I know that that sucks big time for lots of you. The idea that we would have food here that didn't have meat in it means that people who make, you know, our tuna sandwiches and the ease with which we prepare our meals will be challenged. You can tell why I didn't raise this with Scott before I came, or why I didn't talk it over with the board, or even my M&P committee. This is entirely... And if it blows up again this time, again, it's on my shoulders. But I think that we're looking at the destruction of a world that is going to be cataclysmic, that's going to be beyond anything that we can imagine. And it's our children and our children's children and their children and grandchildren who are living with that. And the reality of what that looks like, if that doesn't break your heart, I don't know what might. Because they will be living in a world of scarcity that we have never known. We live in a very privileged environment. Some of us may have known some scarcity as children, growing up in the prairies or growing up having moved to Toronto thinking that there were opportunities here when there weren't. And we went through tough times. But most of us live pretty comfortably. And we have no idea what future generations are going to live like. And so I think that it behooves us to be discomforted, to have to learn to cook a different way, to have to figure out that this egg replacer works in baking and this egg replacer works in making desserts and this egg replacer works in something else, and take the time to learn those things so that we can perhaps cut down our consumption rates in terms of food. Consumption rates in terms of everything else we have in our homes, and that's a good inventory to do, too. You know, how many black skirts do I actually need? You know? But every time I see one on it, that's nice. We all do that. And that's part of what's driving our world to the brink of extinction. I love that line. Let me read it again. Let me find it. Sorry. Lost it. Can't find it. Oh, yes. The only assemblage of life that we know of in the universe. The only assemblage of life, not just us, life that we know of in the universe. What can we do? And what won't we do? What can we do? And what won't we do? I want to have that conversation. I want us to be brave enough to feel what our hearts breaking feels like and then be moved enough to make a difference. Just here. Only here. And if any of you are inspired to do it somewhere else, great. But just here, let's model what that heartbroken reality might look like. Thank you. I have a couple of copies of the article that came out on July 10th that spurred me to share with you today. And I'll put them at the back if you want to read them. At the beginning of my focus moment again, no one said this would be easy. This making things right. This working things out. And some days, we won't even know where to start. I invite you to find life within, find life around you, find the life in which you find your own being amongst friends and family and neighbors. And call yourself to recognize the parts of that are so beautiful to you that they often make you weep, that you wouldn't let go of if your life depended on it, because they're so human, so right, so important, such an expression of everything we can be. And find your way to feeling that generations hence, where those who walk this earth can feel and know and love and celebrate in exactly the same ways as do we, who can feel the depths of pain and loss as deeply as do we, and so measure love against that and know that it is beautiful. Imagine that generations hence. And let us go from this place and work to make that so. Work to keep this world beautiful. All come after, all those we might have loved. Go in peace.
You have been listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.